are so, so very rich, so courageous. I want to say first that I am honored to be part of this dialogue. Like my dear brother and distinguished professor Eduardo Mendiada, that I also believe this is an intellectual feast. There's no doubt about it. That I recall it was almost 40 years ago when I first read Knowledge and Human Interests, and it changed my life. It was the first philosophic text that I gave a public presentation on at Princeton. And to be able now to be in dialogue with Professor Habermas is, in fact, more than a blessing. It's true, I was blessed to sit in a seminar in Frankfurt in 1987 with Roberto Unger and Thomas McCarthy, who's here, who's a towering figure in his own right. But to be part of this dialogue for me is very, very special. The same holds for Charles Taylor. He and I were blessed to be part of a dialogue at Cardozo Law School about maybe 20 years ago, wrestling with Hegel and critical legal studies. But to have him back in New York and to have me be a part of this gets me excited, even though I have a cold. And I apologize for that. And of course, Judith Butler is the leading social theorist of our generation. So when you have the towering European philosopher in the house, the towering North American philosopher and the leading social theorist, and a blues man like me, we're gonna have a good time. And that's what I come to you tonight, as a blues man in the life of the mind, a jazz man in the world of ideas. And what I mean by that is this: I wanna begin with some stage setting. I wanna begin with some metaphilosophic notes. Let's go back to line 607b5 in the 10th book of Plato's Republic, that traditional quarrel between philosophy and poetry, and Plato's attempt to displace Homer for the first time in Western civilization to create a space for something called love of wisdom in a systematic way. People have been loving wisdom for a long time before that. But no, Plato says, there is a way of generating a space in the culture for something called philosophy that it must displace poetry. Well, you see, as a blues man, I believe philosophy must go to school with poetry. And when Beethoven called himself a poet of tones when he walked with Goethe, it includes musicians as well and dancers. I take quite seriously the last line of Shelley's great pamphlet in defense of poetry. Poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world, because what he meant was their poets are not simply versifiers. They're all of us who have the courage to muster empathy and imagination in the face of the chaos that we find ourselves. So in that way, when talking about rethinking secularism, we have to think of the ways in which secular thinkers, namely those who go to school with science, Brother Christopher Hitchens, for example, he must become more religiously musical. He's tone deaf and flat-footed. But it cuts the other way too. Religious persons like myself must be secularly musical, because through empathy and imagination, you're trying to get inside of the world to understand why persons are convinced by this set of arguments, these kinds of reasons as to why they're agnostic or why they're atheistic or what have you. And it's no small thing, because very fragile experiments in democracy could well depend on the not just character and virtues of citizens, but the ability to be multi-contextual in the various frameworks and reason-giving activities in public spaces. And it's not as if there's not conflict in those private spaces either. You know, you go to a synagogue in the evening and watch that fascinating interpretive conflict take place over the Torah. It's just an overarching agreement, you see. How do we mediate that kind of conflict? Now, to put my cards on the table, I do have a particular philosophical anthropology. I don't have time to go into it, but I'll say this quickly. That we're featherless, two-legged, linguistically conscious creatures born between urine and feces. Oh, that's a lot in common, isn't it? Whole lot in common. But our bodies will be the culinary delight of terrestrial worms one day. We're vanishing creatures and disappearing organisms with language on the way to death, on the way to extinction, at least in regard to our bodies. Now, what is significant about that? Well, William James said it so well in the Gifford Lectures. The core of the human problem and religious problem is the call for help. Because when we emerge from our mother's womb, we need help. Oh, that wonderful literary depiction of William James's Gifford Lectures by Nathaniel West. His real name was Nathan Weinstein. He renamed himself. And Miss Lonely Hearts, in that first chapter, is help, help. And the continuity between empathy, imagination, in science, the call to help, predictive powers to control nature, often dominated. But also, when it comes to structures of meaning and structures of value, George Santayana had it right. In Winds of Doctrine, he said, religion is the love of life in the consciousness of impotence. That's worth coughing over. Limit situations, the great Carl Jaspers used to talk about. Death, dread, disappointment. And we know our very English word human comes from the Latin humando, which means burying. Burying the forms of death in life and the fact that we die. Limit, constraint, that what Plato called anange in the Timaeus. What we run up against. And so you would think and hope that we can broaden the scope of empathy and broaden the scope of imagination, both in the dialogue between secular brothers and sisters, atheistic, agnostic, and religious brothers and sisters, but most importantly for me is the prophetic twist. The prophetic twist, you see. Because I decided 49 years ago to pursue a calling. Not just a career, but a calling, a vocation, not just a profession. I was just about 8, but I was precocious. It's true. I was in Shiloh Baptist Church, rich black church. We talked about Martin Luther King Jr., somebody who found unadulterated joy in loving and serving others, be they in chocolate cities or vanilla suburbs. I was deeply impressed. I went to hear him speak. I was persuaded. Something is going on at the level of paideia, at the deepest level of my formation of soul, mind, and heart. Something is going on in this young black boy in Sacramento, California. But it was prophetic. And it's connected to that ninth thesis of the great Walter Benjamin that my dear sister invoked earlier. History as catastrophe, the pile of wreckage on wreckage, the pile of debris, the wasted potential, the unrealized possibility of precious persons. We could begin by looking at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean and seeing millions of African bodies there. But nearly every ocean we see that. Cycles of domination, violence, bigotry, subordination, hatred, and so on. And the prophetic twist, and this is where Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel is, indispensable. Indispensable. The first time in human history, yes, it was a Jewish breakthrough. Not that Jewish brothers and sisters follow through in praxis, but it was a breakthrough of a Jewish folk in the past. All of us fall short of saying there's a distinct way of being in the world, a call for help grounded in the cries of an oppressed people that warrants attention. And in fact, to be human is to love the orphan, the widow, the stranger, to treat that non-Jewish other with dignity, with hesed, with loving kindness. This is a great breakthrough. And in some ways, even our secular discourses are just footnotes to it. Okay, you don't have a cognitive commitment to God. Fine. I see you still love justice. Ah. Jacques Derrida, we started the case, right? A priori claims of justice all of a sudden. All of this deconstructive activity, calling everything into question, and lo and behold, you still tied to fifth chapter of Amos? That justice rolled down like waters? And righteousness like a mighty stream? Interesting, Jacques Derrida. We love you. God bless your soul. I'm with him. He doesn't need to have cognitive commitment to God in that sense, but it's the prophetic, this sense of really believing in the short time that we are here, that something called love thy neighbor, Leviticus 19:18, and justice being what love looks like in public in that tradition, even for the first century Palestinian Jew named Jesus, who comes out of prophetic Judaism, is Jewish to the core. But he's got a logic not of equivalence, love thy neighbor, but a logic of superabundance, to use the wonderful distinction of Paul Ricoeur. And the logic of superabundance is what, love thy enemy. Oh my God, this brother's lost his mind. But what effects and consequences it generates in terms of keeping track of the catastrophic. And that's what I want to note just briefly, because we're going to save good time for dialogue here. The centrality of the catastrophic that sits at the center of prophetic religion. Shelley and Byron, prophetic poets. The catastrophic, the suffering of oppressed people. Not in any kind of abstract way, not in any kind of condescending way, not in any kind of philanthropic or charitable way. Justice being, not even just in solidarity the way our liberation theologians talk about it, actually having a genuine love and willingness to celebrate with those catching hell, the wretched of the earth, in the language of Franz Fanon. How broad, how deep is your empathy? How broad, how deep is one's imagination? You see, right back to Shelley. And most importantly for me, and this is something that makes it difficult for a blues man like myself to remain for too long in academic context, that when you have that kind of orientation, you're always full of righteous indignation. There's a sense of urgency, a state of emergency that has been normalized, hidden, and concealed. And so you get a little suspicious sometimes of the discourses that can easily deodorize the funk that's there. You see, that don't really want to engage the catastrophic, the way in which the U.S. Constitution didn't want to talk about the near genocidal impact of our red brothers and sisters, act as if it don't exist. We saw the same thing with Barack Obama in Philadelphia with the race speech. Slavery was America's first, was original sin. No, 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 you'd almost killed nearly every indigenous person first. Now, they're both affairs of white supremacy, but one came first. Don't deodorize that funk. Their lives are just as precious as any other human life on the globe, no matter what color, what culture, what civilization, coming out of prophetic Judaism. And myself as a Christian, taking seriously this particular Jew who's rooted in that tradition, you see. But this attempt to always ensure that things are not so sterilized and sanitized. And what I find so fascinating is that when we talk about the future of capitalist civilization, let alone democratic possibilities within capitalist civilization, can we imagine having a public discourse without there being voices, not just echoes, voices keeping track of the catastrophic so that elites at the top don't run amok with greed and narrow empathy and truncated imagination? I mean, we're right here in New York City. Wall Street is just right down the way, right? My God, thank God for Paul Krugman, but, well, you know, the catastrophic conditions and circumstances right now in light of corporate elites and financial oligarchs with greed running amok, looting billions and billions of dollars when 21% of America's children live in poverty? That's a crime against humanity. And people will say so 150 years from now, and they'll look back and say, well, what were they doing? The same way we look back at Thomas Jefferson and say, oh, freedom and slavery and relationship. Very human, hypocrisy. It's true for all of us. True for all of us. But how do we create conditions under which the kind of tradition that my dear sister Judith was talking about, remembrance and resistance, remembrance of suffering, not just the suffering of our own mothers and fathers, though they ought to be first. I do believe in priority. That's why I start with my mother. She's the ultimate Negro. My father's co-ultimate Negro. And I begin by loving Negroes first. But I can't love anybody else if I don't love them, especially being shaped by people taught to hate themselves. But that's another lecture. But how do you then allow it to spill over so that there's a robust kind of poetic orientation, so that your empathy is so broad and your imagination is so open-ended that you're willing to be open to different discourses, arguments, pushing you against the wall? That's why my heroes tend to be atheistic and agnostic ones, like Chekhov. There's more empathy and imagination in Chekhov than 99% of Christian churches. Or Beckett, lapsed Christian. Or Kafka, catastrophic at the very beginning in the Metamorphosis. Look at that unbelievable compassion flowing for Gregor and his relation to his violin playing sister. Or Toni Morrison, who happens to be Catholic and Christian and black, so I don't have to worry about that too much. But dealing with the catastrophic and the response to the catastrophic. You know, Ralph Waldo Emerson used to say, what, the blues ain't nothing but a autobiographical chronicle of a personal catastrophe expressed lyrically. It's a lyrical response to catastrophe. Nobody loves me but my mama. She might be driving too. That's B.B. King. A strange fruit the southern trees bear. That's called American terrorism. Lynching for almost 90 years. That's Billie Holiday with Jewish Brother Maripol writing the lyrics. How do we deal with the catastrophic when we cast a light on it and have the courage to confront it, and most importantly, have the courage to organize and mobilize to bring our voices together in order to pressure those in power? I'm going to close with the notion of utopian interruptions, because what I'm talking about is always tied to failure. It's no accident that the figure that I invoke, Beckett's got an aesthetics of failure, doesn't he? So does Chekhov. So does Kafka. That wonderful letter that Benjamin writes to Scholem, July 1938. You'll never understand the purity and the beauty of Kafka if you don't view him as a failure. And of course, if it wasn't for Max Brauer, we wouldn't even have the text. Kafka believed he was a failure through and through. Or as Beckett says in his last piece of prose fiction, Wordsworth Ho, try again, fail again, fail better. Try again, fail again, fail better. Prophetic religion is positive, progressive power, the negative power, the ugly power, always operating. When religions are well adjusted to greed and fear and bigotry, it has its power too. I'm talking about prophetic religion. It's always tied to some failure. Always. There's moments like the 1960s. We come together. An awakening takes place, another major trope in Benjamin's work. Doesn't last too long because the powers that be are not just mighty, but they're very clever, and they dilute and incorporate in very clever ways. In this age of Obama, many of us broke our necks to bring the age of Reagan and the era of conservatism to a close. Now with the age of Obama, the question becomes, can prophetic religion in all of its various forms mobilize people, generate levels of righteous indignation against injustice, not raw anger at persons, not ad hominem attacks? Can it put pressure on President Obama? Because he's listening to technocratic elites in his economic team who never had any concern with poor people and working people. He's mesmerized by their braininess and tantalized by their establishment status. Same is true with his neo-imperial team and foreign policy. But what's fascinating is he was able to mobilize based on a democratic rhetoric and end up with technocratic policies. Well, we've seen that before. He's got progressive instincts. Will he stand up? We want to talk about a health care plan. My God. My God. But in talking about prophetic religion, we're talking about something that is engaging, something that is risk-taking, and it has everything to do with the enabling virtue, which is courage. The courage to expand empathy, expand imagination, think critically, organize, mobilize, and maybe, like Brother Martin, pay the ultimate price. But it's all in bearing witness. Bearing witness. That's what the call is about. That's what the vocation is about. And I'm so glad I could bear witness a little bit here tonight. Thanks, Lord.